So first of all, I want to apologize for screwing up a little bit in the last lecture, and I just want to, and I realize that it's also, there may be this mismatch because I don't know what you know and what you don't know. And so I did something where if you don't know this, it might seem very mysterious. So let me just do an aside and then sort of fix what I did last lecture. So suppose you want to compute the following integral. 0 to infinity, dx, e to the n, f of x, this integral, where n we like to think of very large, like thermodynamic, 10 to the 23, and f of x as a single maximum. And so the idea here is that, well, if f of x is a single maximum, so, you know, here is a plot as a function of x. Let's do logarithm so it doesn't go off to the end of the universe. So here might be f of x. But then e to the n f of x might look something like this. Because n is huge. And so under that circumstance, then we can, it's what's called the asymptotic evaluation of this integral. We can do a couple of tricks to evaluate this integral. So this we send, well, the thing is that it's only near the maximum that's a dominant contribution to the integral. You know, like if you sort of draw the area under the curve, almost all of it is happening where f of x has a maximum. So let's put a single max at x naught. And so under those circumstances, we can do the following steps, which seem maybe not so well justified, but can be justified if you want it, you know, if you look in a math book. First of all, we can send the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, x. And then we can write this as e to the n, and then I'll write this as f of x naught, the value at the maximum. And then I'll do a Taylor series expansion about the maximum. So the first derivative term is 0, and the second derivative term, by construction, because it's a maximum, it's a negative. And so it's 1 half x minus x naught squared f double prime at x naught plus dot, dot, dot. And again, there's higher order terms. And you know, one has to work a little bit harder to show you can ignore everything. So this is the first crucial step, is that we're doing something which almost seems self-inconsistent in the sense that we're doing a Taylor series expansion about x naught and then sending the limits of the integral to minus infinity to plus infinity if it started from, say, 0 to infinity, or even any finite range that included x naught. And then the point here is that this is a constant. This is a Gaussian integral. And so this is equal to e to the n f of x naught. And then we do the Gaussian integral. We get 2 pi over f double prime x naught. And so, 2 pi.
Are we just basically taking the integral to the second order
term? That's correct. Yeah, so the thing is that there are higher order terms here, but again, this requires a lot more work to show that you can ignore them, but you can ignore them asymptotically. Okay. So if I call this integral I of x, no, so this is just I of n. So the point here, and I'm worried about my factor of n here. So there is n f naught. So this is 2 over n. Sorry. So the point here is that I of n is actually the right thing is called asymptotic to. And so this thing, you know, you've seen it many times and probably used it all the time. And it's like you think it's sort of like, kind of like, approximately equal to. But it has a precise mathematical meaning. This thing is asymptotic to. And what does that mean? So, you know, f of x.
Sorry, is it minus half x minus x naught or plus half x minus x naught?
Minus, because it's a maximum.
Taylor expansion.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I said that, you know, f has a single maximum. Okay. Sorry. So the point is that f of x is asymptotic to g of x. What this means So this, first of all, when you say something is asymptotic to something else, it's in the limit as something, as you, as something happens. So this is, say, as x goes to y. And what this means is that limit f of x over g of x as x goes to y equals 1. So that's the formal definition of is asymptotic to. So this integral, which we've done by this expansion of the Gaussian, is it gives us that the integral we get is the I of n is asymptotic to this functional form. So there are other terms here which will vanish in this particular case as n goes to infinity. Here, the natural variable is n, and we're looking at the limit n going to infinity. So anyways, that is the principle behind which I was then doing this thing of trying to write the partition function equal to an integral from 0 to infinity dE. And then I had e to the, I guess it was beta ts of e minus e. That's what I was trying to calculate. And again, the crucial point here is that it's as a function of the energy we're trying to then maximize this thing. So we have to look at the integrand as a function of any function of energy. So when I was getting all messed up about differentiating the, you know, with respect to energy, you don't differentiate this guy, you don't differentiate this guy. It's only the functions of energy that you're ending up differentiating. And that's how you get the right answer. So anyway, so that's just a mathematical aside.
Sorry, is it? And that's because we are this integral, the quantity E is not the equilibrium energy.
That's right. This is because this is now, we're integrating over all possible energies. And there is one value of the energy that maximized the integrand. That's like the peak over here. And then the contribution of like the width of this function gives rise to these lower order terms. Okay, so that's all I had. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that T the temperature of the reservoir?
So I don't. Equilibrium temperature? This is the equilibrium temperature, but from the point of view of this integral, it's like it doesn't depend on the, you know, the energy is the running index here that we're trying to maximize the integrand with respect to the energy. So it's just, you can treat it as a constant. And it is though the equilibrium temperature of the system. Yep, keep asking.
Are you saying that beta is very big?
I'm not saying anything about beta. Well, see, oh yeah, so the one other difference, okay, very good point, which is that notice here that E is proportional to N. You know, N is the energy of the system is proportional to the size of the system. And also the entropy here is proportional to N. So the large parameter here is kind of hidden because there's N everywhere multiplying. Here I had it sitting out here explicitly. Okay, so let's now turn to what I was starting to talk about yesterday. And that was a ferromagnetism. Magnetism. And so in a ferromagnetic system, we have this natural phase diagram as a function of temperature and magnetic field. Magnetic field is H. So as a function of temperature and magnetic field, so if the magnetic field is positive, the spins tend to align with the magnetic field. So here we have spins pointing, say, up. If I'm imagining now, and I'm going to, for the sake of all this discussion, I'm just going to imagine two spin states, either spin up or spin down. So in this region of the state space, phase space, you have spin up. Here you have spin down. And there is a first order, a line of first order transitions up to a critical temperature TC. And so this is a first order transition. This is a second order transition. And I'll be a little bit more precise what I mean by these things. And then out here above the critical temperature, there is no transition. A smooth change from positive magnetization to negative magnetization. And so if I plot for fixed temperatures, what happens is I cross this, the line h equals 0. So here, if I plot as a function of magnetic field, the magnetization. So the magnetization here starts positive. Oh, let's move this over a bit. Magnetization is a function of magnetic field. So it starts off positive. It decreases as a decrease in magnetic field, but there is a jump in the magnetization as I go from plus phase to minus phase. And so you have something that looks like this. So this is for T less than TC. And the fact that there is a jump in the magnetization, and here the magnetization is what's known formally as the order parameter of the system. It's measuring if there's order or no order. And the fact that there is a jump in the magnetization means that this is a first order phase transition. And at TC, same plot, m as a function of h, one has something where it comes in with infinite slope. And so this is at TC. And so here, as we're going to derive momentarily, we're going to find that m scales as h, the 1 over delta. Delta is one of the four major critical point exponents that describes what happens at a second order phase transition. I'll elaborate more about this momentarily. And finally, above TC, same plot, you just have that the magnetization goes linearly to zero and changes sign. And so that's sort of a signal that there's really no phase transition because nothing dramatic is happening as you cross the line above the critical point.
Sorry, I don't understand how from this diagram H with respect to T, you got that. I'm seeing the arrows, but
yes.
I don't understand the diagram. The
so the thing is that let's admit
arrows. I know how from up they go down one
right.
critical temperature, but I don't understand the diagram and the thing that you did.
Well, this is meant to just sort of indicate a first order phase transition line. So all along this line, we have this kind of transition. So if I cross here, anywhere along here, there'll be a jump in the magnetization. The jump will get smaller as they get closer to the critical temperature. And then at the critical temperature, the jump goes to zero. And the sign that it goes to zero, the jump going to zero, is that there's an infinite slope.
No, but what is the oscillation thing that you're drawing?
Oh, no. The oscillation, that's just artistic license. I mean, this is a line of first order transitions. I drew it squiggly just to sort of indicate, or I could have drawn it with a different color chalk. Yeah. Okay. So one thing that I'd like to put to rest or say a little bit more about is that why do we focus? Why do we care? Why care about criticality? Or at TC? Ask away.
What is the delta
in H? So delta is one of the critical point exponents. If you give me 5 more minutes, okay, I'll put it into a more general context. But treat it now, this is just some power law behavior such that it comes in with infinite slope. So first question is, why do we even care about criticality? And so the thing is that this was like the major achievement of the normalization group and scaling theory and all that kind of stuff. And, it was in the 70s and 80s when I was like in my formative years, like everybody was working on the renormalization group. And it was a big deal. And, it got Ken Wilson a Nobel Prize. And so to try and like put this in context, let's sort of think conceptually, like what the system looks like out here and here and at the critical point. And so the point is that if I'm, so let me like declutter this a little bit so I can maybe draw some stuff. So in this part of the phase diagram, the magnetic field is down. So if I were to take a snapshot of the system, I would see that I would have system, all the spins are down, almost all the spins are down. And then somewhere there might be like little bubbles of positive spin. So I'm sorry I'm drawing so small. Can you guys see that in the back? So you'll have little bubbles of defects in a sea of down spins. And so if you want to try and calculate, like, what is the magnetization in this regime, one can rely on perturbation theory, standard techniques that we've known from physics for the past couple of hundred years. You can look, you say that this is almost magnetization down with some perturbation, and one can do some perturbation theory, and one can understand the behavior of the system. On the other hand, if I'm way out here at very high temperature, then the system looks completely disordered. So if I were to try and draw a snapshot of the system, there'll be plus spins, minus, plus, minus. They're all over the place, randomly oriented. But somewhere, it might be a little bubble of ordering. And so one can do a perturbation theory in these little bubbles of ordering. And as you lower the temperature, these bubbles of ordering will get larger and larger. Whereas if I increase the temperature here, these bubbles of misaligned spins will also get larger and larger. And at the critical point, these perturbations actually involve all size scales. So at the critical point, there's all size scales represented. And so that's one sort of crucial point about what's happening at the critical point, because one has fluctuations at all size scales. So any kind of a perturbative approach is doomed to failure. And since until, you know, the 70s, I mean, most people relied on perturbation theory, people had no idea how to proceed. And so it was the brilliance of people like Wilson, Kadnoff, Fisher, Widom, who realized that when you have all size scales represented, one has to develop a completely different calculational scheme to understand the behavior at the critical point. And so this is something I'll say something about, you know, a little bit later on. So why we care about criticality at the critical point is, first of all, there is this notion of scale invariance. And what do I mean by scale invariance is that if all size scales are represented, that means that if you look at the system at this scale or at that scale or at the scale of the universe, you'll see fluctuations of all different sizes. And so the system kind of looks the same no matter at what scale you're looking at it. This notion of scale invariance is extremely important because it actually provides a clue about how we try and treat the system at the critical point. So that's one important feature, scale invariance. And then the other thing is that then there's large scale collective behavior. Namely, as we're going to see, there's a spread of correlations of spins. Like if a spin is pointing up here, and if you're at the critical point, it can influence spins very far away. So it's the same as, like, maybe you've heard this quote from, you know, people talk about the weather, that like a butterfly flapping its wings in China can then cause a hurricane in Florida 2 weeks later down the road. So there's large-scale correlations or large-scale collective behavior. And that's another reason why perturbative approaches just simply don't work. And just to give you a historical context, when I was getting my PhD, I did work on perturbative theories to try and understand the phase transition. And so this was an approach that was just doomed to not be very helpful because it's just not the right way to deal with the problem altogether. So if you're working on a doomed project like I did, well, you know, you can survive it.
Sorry.
The other thing is that there's large fluctuations. And what I mean by large fluctuations is that near the critical point, because you have like islands of plus and islands of minus of all sizes represented, in a dynamical setting, these fluctuations can change easily between plus and minus. And those are the large fluctuations that are characteristic of a critical point.
Sorry.
Yep.
I should have asked this earlier.
Sure.
The phase diagram that we're studying is for the 2D?
This is for any dimensional Ising model above one.
Okay. And one more thing is, what is the difference between large-scale collective behavior and long-range correlations?
Well, I mean, there may be like different sides of the same coin. What I mean by long-range correlations is that if I'm a spin up, you know, like by the Ising interaction, I'm trying to tell my neighbors, you should all point up. But then my neighbors also will tell their neighbors to point up. And at the critical point, this sort of chain of like playing the game of telephone can spread large distances. You'll see that I'm going to be more mathematical about this momentarily. Yes?
I'm a little confused. focus on like the definition of like a t critical, because I always assumed like, you know, past, like below the critical temperature, you'd have all the spins aligned.
Yes.
But if you don't have all the spins aligned and there's like little bubbles.
Well, no, thing is, below the critical temperature, not all the spins are aligned. Most of them are aligned. So again, I'll be a little bit more mathematical, but I will derive the dependence of the magnetization or the order parameter as a function of temperature. And you'll see that it suddenly rises to non-zero values below the critical temperature, but only reaches one at T equals zero. So it's not sort of sudden that you suddenly have perfect ordering. It's like you have ordering, but it's not perfect.
Okay.
And the last thing I just want to mention about here is that there's like power law scaling. And so what we're going to see is that many observables or response functions all have power law dependencies on a critical parameter, which is the deviation of the temperature from the critical temperature. And again, as you get more into physics, you'll learn that people who, there's a subset of people like myself who kind of salivate when we see power law behaviors, because it means scale invariance, it means, you know, emergent behavior, it means all kinds of things that are much beyond good old perturbation theory. And, you know, so it's considered kind of, I guess you would call it kind of sexy and cool. So anyways, so let's now talk a little bit more precisely about critical behaviors or critical, I don't know. Okay, critical behavior. Because now I get a chance to show that I'm Canadian by putting the U there. So there's four basic response functions or like observables. There's the magnetization as a function of temperature. And near the critical point, this magnetization scales as Tc minus T to the power beta. So notice that it's equal to zero for T larger than Tc. So this is true for T less than Tc. So the magnetization is zero above the critical temperature. At the critical temperature, it rises in a power law fashion. And we're going to derive what the exponent beta is in mean field theory pretty soon. And so this is one important feature. But again, the thing to answer your question is that, so you see that if T is like, say, a half Tc, this is not equal to one. It's something which only reaches one at temperature equals zero.
I'm sorry, beta is not a temperature, right?
Pardon me?
Beta is not the temperature.
Beta is a critical point exponent. So, yeah, so there's going to be an alphabet soup that I'm going to introduce. There's alpha, beta, gamma, delta, which are the four critical point exponents, and this is sort of the most obvious of them. And then there's the heat capacity. And so if I'm dealing with a magnetic system, the heat capacity, so this scales as T minus or Tc minus T to the power alpha. And so there's another critical point exponent. There is the magnetic susceptibility, and this scales as T minus Tc to the power minus gamma. And finally, there is the critical isotherm exponent, so M scales as H to the 1 over delta. So these four things, you know, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, are called critical point exponents. And during my time as an undergraduate and graduate student, I mean, that's what people were doing. Everyone was calculating critical point exponents, trying to get them more accurate. The crucial feature about these things is that there is a universal behavior. These critical point exponents are, it turns out that they're independent of the relevant details. And so then you might ask, so what are irrelevant details and what are relevant details? So it turns out that, so this is really actually very important, this notion of universality, that things don't depend on details is like one thing that we who work in stat mech really have come to love, like what's important and what's not. And so it turns out that if you know what's relevant and what's not, you can just throw away things that are just irrelevant. We're going to see in the context of the renormalization group, there's a lot of that throwing away of irrelevant details. And so what are the relevant details? So what is relevant? There's the dimension of space. This turns out to be the most important relevant parameter. And so in fact, in Wilson's paper that essentially was cited when he won the Nobel Prize, he wrote about critical phenomena in 3.99 dimensions. And so that was one of the brilliance of his approach, is that, you know, in the early days when people were first seeing critical point behavior, we didn't know what was important, what was not. And it was, he was able to realize that the spatial dimension is actually a relevant parameter. And so, you know, physics, a lot of times, if you have like something which is fixed, like we live in three dimensions, but no, let's treat dimension as a free parameter that we can fiddle around with and do a perturbation theory. And so he did a perturbation theory in the deviation from four dimensions. So it turns out that for D larger than or equal to four, there is what's called mean field behavior. And so maybe let me be a little bit more precise. Remember, this is D equals, so let's just keep it that way. So from this, I infer an upper critical dimension. Critical dimension, DC equals to four. So above four dimensions, as we're going to see, the critical behavior is in some sense simple. Because fluctuations don't play a large role. And it turns out that the critical point exponents are the same if I'm doing the Ising model in 17 dimensions, 103 dimensions, or 5 dimensions. It all has the same critical behavior. Details might depend on what dimension you're living in, but the critical point exponents do not. So this is a very important insight, that there is this range of dimensions where the dimension doesn't matter. On the other hand, D equals 1, we're going to see there is no transition. There's no critical behavior in the one-dimensional Ising model, which is why Ernst Ising was a junior college instructor rather than like a world-famous physicist. But then between D, between less than 4 and greater than 1, there is non-mean field behavior. And I'm just going to call it critical behavior because it sounds a bit more sexy. Critical behavior. And what I mean by critical behavior is, or maybe I'll call it non-trivial, in that the critical point exponents actually depend on the spatial dimension. And we're not going to get into like all the details of calculating critical point exponents, but suffice it to say that the critical point exponents do depend on the spatial dimension. Then there's one more parameter here, which is n, which is the dimensionality of the spin space. So what I mean by this is, say the Ising model, where spins can either point up or down, the spin lies on a one-dimensional axis, say the z axis. Again, showing my Canadian roots, z axis. But you could imagine spins that live on the along the circumference of a circle, or a spin that lives in three dimensions. And so this n is 1 for the Ising model. It's 2 for the so-called XY model, where spins can lie anywhere on the XY plane, or 3 for the Heisenberg model, where spins can lie anywhere on the surface of a sphere. And so this is another parameter on which the exponents depend. But, you know, really, like, the meat of the problem is just dealing with the Ising model. So I'm not going to worry about larger values of n, because that's that's a whole course by itself. Okay, so I guess that's everything I wanted to say about sort of descriptive on critical behavior. So yes.
Just to make sure, these two D and N are specific to Fermi mechanism, or is it?
Yes. So I'm always thinking about a ferromagnetic system here. Yeah. Yes.
So is it fair to say in the thermodynamic limits, the Ising model is entirely characterized by the dimension of the space?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What happens if the dimension is less than 1?
Dimension is less than 1. Well, I mean, the thing is that because there's no order in one dimension, there's even less order in less than one dimension. I mean, the problem is that, like, how do you have a fractional dimension? So that's usually with a fractal. But what's a typical example of a less than a one-dimensional system? It's like a Cantor set, which is very disconnected. So it's like the spins are just isolated by themselves, and so they don't talk to anybody. So it's a completely non-interacting system.
Okay.
So ferromagnetism in less than one dimension doesn't really make any sense. Okay, so let's see. Let's put this. Okay. So again, I think I already wrote some of this down last time, but I don't think it hurts to just repeat. So let's talk about the Ising model, because that's going to be our fruit fly of trying to understand ferromagnetism. So the Hamiltonian that describes the Ising model is minus J summation over nearest neighbors on a lattice. So let's write this with angle brackets just once to sort of emphasize we're talking about nearest neighbors on a lattice. So I imagine I have a lattice. It can be a square lattice or whatever lattice you want, hypercubic or FCC, BCC. And at each side of a lattice, so this is site I of a lattice, there is an Ising spin, which can either point up or down. And here is site J, which is a neighbor to I. And here the spin can again point up or down. And the interaction is minus J, SI, SJ. And here SI is restricted to have the values plus or minus 1, nothing else. So that is the good old Ising model. And before we go any further about this, I mean, I just want to point out a number of like important restrictions that this Ising model as written contains. So first of all, it's nearest neighbor interactions. And I think I did mention this last time that, you know, in reality, the interactions of any kind of a magnetic spin inside of a material does fall off with distance in some way, but it turns out that as long as the interaction falls off sufficiently fast, and this is one of the insights that comes from the normalization group, is that it's the same critical behavior as if there's only near neighbor interactions and nothing else. So for simplicity, we'll deal with only nearest neighbor interactions. Second point is that there's no disorder. So I'm assuming that every single link between neighboring sites has exactly the same interaction strength. And you certainly know that in any real solid state material, there are defects, there's all kinds of things going on. So the interactions in reality cannot be perfectly homogeneous. But again, and this is an insight that comes from like scaling theory and normalization group, if you allow for a little bit of disorder, like if you put the J inside the sum and said it's JIJ for the ijth pair, there's a different interaction strength. As long as the width of the distribution of disorder is not very wide, then it's the same as a ferromagnetic Ising model. So again, in the framework of complete simplicity, we'll deal with the case of no disorder. And then the other thing is also, you know, only two spin states. So once again, you might say, well, suppose I allowed the possibility that a spin could have values plus one, minus one, or zero. Like if you're thinking about quantum mechanics, like, you know, spin a half system, you have spin up, spin down. Spin one system is one, zero, minus one, spin three halves, plus three halves, one half, minus a half. You know, you could imagine all of that. We could imagine a spin that had a continuous value that went continuously between plus one and minus one. All of those details don't matter. So let's always deal with the simplest case. So these are kind of the basic sort of swept under the rug approximations that we normally do, and we study just the good old one-dimensional Ising model. What I'm going to do now is, thinking about the dimension dependence, I'm going to go first and discuss the mean field solution, which is simple. I'm going to talk about the one-dimensional solution. And if I gave an entire course about the two-dimensional Ising model, I could spend the next 1 year, you know, showing you how to solve the 2D Ising model and all the beautiful techniques that are done there. But I'm going to essentially skip all of that because that's a very specialized thing. But just to get a sense of like, what is the critical behavior? We'll do the mean field solution, which essentially contains all the critical behavior. We'll calculate all of these critical point exponents in the mean field limit. And then we'll talk about the one-dimensional case because it's very pretty and very sweet. And then we'll move on to the renormalization group. Okay. So mean field solution. Oh, sorry. Maybe I should. Maybe I should make this go. Solution. So there's two ways that one can do the mean field solution. One way, which is kind of cool, is that you imagine that your spins, instead of living on a lattice, live on a complete graph. A complete graph is a very special type of graph in which every single site is connected to everybody else. So if you have n sites, so let me just draw it here. If I have three sites, this is a complete graph of three sites. If I have four sites, then I do something like this. And as you add, as you make more sites, you would have, if you have n sites, you'll have n combination two links, and everybody's connected to everybody else. And because of that feature, you can show that in the limit as n goes to infinity, fluctuations so there's two types of fluctuations in the sense of what's happening here. One is large distance fluctuations, and one is like, is every spin look the same as every other spin? And in this complete graph limit, every spin essentially sees the same environment and has the same average magnetization, and that's a simple case to deal with. I'm going to deal with another way of deriving the mean field solution, which is just to say by fiat, I'm going to assume that every spin has the average magnetization. And under that assumption, as you'll see, we can solve the problem and we'll calculate all the critical behaviors. Okay, so in the mean field solution, what I have in mind here is that here is, let's now call this the origin. So here is zero, and this is S0, the spin at the origin. And here is site I, and here is a spin at SI. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to write the Hamiltonian of, and so let's write it for just one spin, the spin S0. What is its Hamiltonian? So this is going to be equal to minus J summation over I. And in this particular case, if I'm doing a square lattice, it'd be four neighbors, east, north, west, and south. So I sum over these four neighbors. And then it's going to be S0 SI. And so the point here is that if I focus my attention on a spin at zero, it's feeling the interaction of its four neighbors. And I'm going to say, well, that is like the local field acting at site zero is the local field. So this, let me write it this way. So I can write this as minus S0 sum over I JSI. And so I'm going to think of this as like the local field. And the idea here is to say, well, I'm going to say that every spin, you know, each of these SIs is just the average spin in the ferromagnetic phase. And so this I'm going to replace by minus S0, and then there's a J. And so I'm going to replace, okay, so let me do one more step here, summation over I, and then we'll write this as SI. So I'm replacing the true value of the spin by its average value. And so this then gives me H of S0 is equal to minus J. Minus J S0. And then in this case, so this thing, the average spin, this is nothing more than the magnetization per spin. So that's what I'm going to replace by M. And so it's going to be, in this particular case, it's JZ M. And here, Z is the coordination number of the lattice. This is a standard notation, coordination number of the lattice. So once I do this very drastic approximation of replacing the true spin by its average spin, now we basically have a paramagnetic system where the magnetic field is the sum of the true magnetic field plus the local field, which I've smoothed out and made it homogeneous throughout the entire system. So now we can solve for the magnetization. So the magnetization, I'm just going to copy from last time, hyperbolic tanh of beta H, that was the true field, but now I have to add plus the local field. So that's going to be JZM. So that's my mean field solution for the magnetization of the mean field Ising model.
What's Z again?
Z is the coordination number of the lattice. So in this particular case, it's 4. It was a other, yeah. Yes?
So here we are assuming that Si is only next to S0.
Pardon me?
Si is only next to S0.
That's right. So Si in this particular case, you know, this would be like the sum, you know, east, north, west, and south, those four neighbors.
And can you explain why you have JZM in the.
So again, the point here is that. This, so maybe I'll write one more step here. This is going to be like minus S0 H effective. Because the sum of the interaction strength times the number of spins you're interacting with times the magnetization is how much field that spin feels. So this is like an effective magnetic field felt by the spin in addition to the true magnetic field that I put from a magnet from the outside. You had a question?
Which one is the field? When you say local field, is it the sum that includes the coupling constant or?
Yes, it includes the coupling constant. So again, JZM is the magnetic, effective magnetic field. All right, keep going. Yeah.
In that formula of M,
mm-hmm.
you define it recursively.
Well, so that's what we're going to do. Give me 5 minutes. I'm gonna do exactly that. Okay. So, anyways, that's what it looks like.
Sorry,
and sure.
Z is, for example, just to understand, if it was a square lattice, it would be 4.
Right. Yeah. And if it's triangular lattice, it's 6. Or FCC, it's 12. Whatever lattice you're dealing with. Okay. So the thing is that what's interesting here is we know that already for like the paramagnet, if there's no magnetic field, there's no magnetization. If there is a magnetic field, there is magnetization. But there's no spontaneous magnetization. So let's try and investigate the possibility of spontaneous magnetization. In this case, let's look at this for H equals 0. So at H equals 0, we have M is equal to hyperbolic tanh of beta JZM. And so the question is, what are the nature of the solutions to this equation? So, now, if Big Brother will please put down the screen, I hope, because I have something to show here. Let's see what happens. Wow. All right, and then hopefully my laptop is going to show something. Let's see. Okay. So do I have to do anything to make my laptop project? What does it say? You cannot start share because this feature is not allowed. Okay, there we are. Good. Okay. So what I'm plotting here, let's move this a little bit here. So here I have the temperature, which I can fiddle with. So that's, and so it turns out that this is above the critical temperature. And so the plot, the blue is just on the x-axis, it didn't show up. So it's a magnetization. So the y-axis is magnetization. So you see a little m here. The x-axis is just between minus 1 and plus 1. And so the blue line is just the plot m equals m. And so unfortunately, you know, my solution is now buried back here. So let me just put it over here. M was equal to hyperbolic tangent of beta JZM. So the blue is just a line of slope 1. And so as a function of the temperature, the red line is tanh beta JZM. And so let's play with this thing and see what happens. So as we lower the temperature, so here we're starting at temperature 2. We're lowering it. So there's one solution where T tangent beta JZM is equal to M. So that's solution M equals zero, no magnetization. But as we lower the temperature, so I'm lowering, you see that the hyperbolic tangent has a sigmoidal type shape. And then something happens at temperature equals one. Let's go this way. So there's at 1.1. And then at temperature equals one, the two lines, the red line or the red curve, which goes into a line near M equals zero, is tangent to the blue. And below that point, you see now the birth of two new solutions, a solution here and a solution here. So we go from one solution to three solutions. And those two other solutions, non-zero magnetization, are the ferromagnetic phase. And so this is the birth of the magnetization as the temperature is lowered below TC. And as I lower the temperature further, those two solutions move further and further out towards M equals one. And finally, at zero temperature, you get basically magnetization equals one. And that's what happens. So that's the graphical solution to that problem. So thank you for that slide. I'll have something maybe about half an hour from now, but let's call it a day with that for now. So maybe that gives a hint that I don't need this anymore. So yeah, thank you. Great. I'm finding it very funny to. So I guess we're getting close to a break point, but let me just go on 5 more minutes, and then we can take a rest. Okay. So we want to solve this equation. You were going to ask? No? Okay. All right. So what I want to say here. Yeah. So let's maybe put it here. So this is our basic equation. And so first of all, you see it's a transcendental equation. You have like a hyperbolic tangent equals an algebraic function. You can't solve it in a closed form, but you can solve it perturbatively and graphically as well as what I've done. So let's look at, just below TC. Well, okay, first of all, we're at critical temperature. What is the critical temperature? So we've seen then when this argument was equal to one is where like the solutions crossed each other. So the critical temperature is defined by beta C, so that's the critical temperature, JZ equals 1. Or another way of putting it, because beta is 1 over KT, this is KTC equal to JZ. So that's the definition of the critical temperature. And you see that as you increase the interactions, the critical temperature goes up. And that sort of makes perfect sense, because if you're more strongly coupled, then it means that you can preserve ferromagnetic order to even a higher temperature. And so the critical temperature scales linearly with the strength of the interaction. It also scales linearly with the number of neighbors, because the more neighbors you have, the more tightly coupled you are, the more you're going to have to thermally agitate, try and destroy the ferromagnetic ordering. Okay. And so now if we want to solve this equation,
For H is zero, or is this for
H? Yes, I'm talking only about H equals zero, because I'm interested in the phenomenon of spontaneous magnetization, where it comes not because I'm pushing you to do something. It's like all you guys here are pushing yourselves to do something. So spontaneous magnetization. So.
Could you say again why the critical temperature is defined by that equation?
Because we saw, in my slide here, we had something which looked like, basically, if I call all of this stuff here X, then if I plot, did this plot, so I am plotting here magnetization. So the left-hand side is M is equal to M. So that was a straight line. And the right-hand side was tanh X times M. If X is less than 1, that means that near the origin, this comes in with a slope less than 1. And so there's clearly only one solution. If X is bigger than 1, the slope of this will be larger than 1. And so it comes in with a slope larger than 1. And because it's a tanh function, which has a sigmoidal shape, now there's another solutions here and here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, so how do we now calculate something useful out of this? So let's look for let's consider the case t less than and slightly smaller than tc, because we've seen already that above tc there's no magnetization, so there's nothing to discuss. Let's look in this limit. So the thing is that when the temperature is just below the critical temperature, we saw that these two solutions that are born, they're born continuously from the origin. So let's take the limit m going to zero. And again, in a lot of this phase transition phenomenology, it's really important to think about asymptotic behaviors. And so certainly when I was a graduate student, I thought, well, the word asymptotic meant kind of like a bullshitty term, sort of like. But I hope I've given you a sense that there is a precise mathematical definition to asymptotic behavior. And so in the limit at m going to zero, we can write this as m is equal to, so now we just expand the hyperbolic tangent for small m. And so the first term is beta jzm. And then this next term is minus 1/3 beta jzm cubed plus higher order terms. And again, you know, you can check for yourself that if I, what I'm going to throw away doesn't really matter. And so let's try and do something with this. So here is a little useful trick, which is I'll write beta jzm as beta c jz, and then times beta over beta c. So I haven't done anything. Minus 1/3 beta jz cubed. But this is 1, just by construction, by definition. And then this, well, beta is 1 over kt, beta c is 1 over ktc. So I can write this as tc over tm minus 1/3. And then here I'll write this as, this is a j, not, and so this was equal to jz over kt cubed. And so let's just, whoops, I lost the magnetization. So this is 1/3 m cubed, 1/3 m cubed. So I bring this to the left-hand side, and so I'm going to get m 1 minus tc over t is equal to m 3 over 3 times jz over kt quantity cubed. And again, I can do the same trick on the right-hand side. This is m cubed over 3. And so jz is ktc. So this is going to be tc over t cubed. And so I can cancel 1 power of m. And so what I get then finally is that m, and this, so I should be a little bit more careful here. This is asymptotic too, because I'm throwing away plus dot, 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 plus dot, dot, dot. And now I throw these terms away. And so I'm going to have m is equal to 3, 1 minus tc over t, m squared, times t over tc quantity cubed. So this is the mean field solution for the magnetization of the Ising model. And so from this, we infer that m is, you know, asymptotic to 3. And so I can write this as
t minus tc over t minus 1.
Say it again?
I think it should have been tc over t minus 1.
Tc?
I mean, the minus of that thing, because 1 minus tc over t is not, it's negative. You missed a negative sign, I suppose.
Did I miss a negative sign? 1 minus tc over t.
Yeah, you took that to the other side, and the right-hand side was had a minus sign.
I'm sorry. I bring this over here. I have 1 minus tc over t. Oh, yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Tc over t minus 1. Thank you. And so is this line correct? So this is 1 minus tc.
That has a minus sign as well. Yeah. Because it's 1 minus tc over t.
Oh, yeah, no. Here is the minus sign over here. That's where, yeah, okay. Very good. Okay. Anyway, so this is correct, so fine. Thank you. Tc over t minus 1 times t over tc cubed square root. And so from this, we infer that the critical exponent beta, which was defined somewhere here, so the magnetization as t goes below tc, it scales as tc minus t to the power 1/2. So beta is equal to 1/2. So that is the critical exponent beta. So that's one of the four members of the alphabet soup with critical point exponents.
I'm sorry, sir. Could you say what the asymptotic series expansion parameter is? what are we expanding in?
We're expanding in the limit of t going to tc or magnetization going to zero. Either of those is they're essentially equivalent parameters. And so in the limit, as t goes to tc, this is asymptotically correct because there's higher order terms that don't matter as t goes to tc.
But I thought the magnetization would be zero even for temperatures much larger than tc.
No, it is zero above tc. So again, there's a discontinuity in the nature of the solutions, because for T above TC, this equation gives me one solution, and magnetization equals zero. Below TC, this equation gives me three solutions, and now I'm investigating the nature of these other two solutions, which have this behavior. So why don't we take like a 3-minute break, and we'll reconvene in 3 minutes or so. And if you want to ask more questions, just ask away. And next time, I'm going to bring a bottle of water.
You said that the critical behavior of magnetization behaves a power law. So not
I hate being up here. This is just very, very, yeah, go ahead.
You said your behavior of the magnetization is like a power law. So you have the TC minus beta, and
right
here you said beta is equal to 1/2, but what happens with T over TC here?
Well, but as you get close to the critical point, that ratio goes to 1, so it doesn't have any, it doesn't do any very much.
But as T approaches TC, TC minus T also goes to 0, so
TC over T goes to 1. So the thing is that again, like you know, if I define t, you know, so let's look at t just below tc. So t is equal to tc and minus something. And it's better to do like dimensionless small parameters. So let's call it tc1 minus epsilon. Okay, so t over tc is equal to 1 minus epsilon. And so 1 minus tc over T is equal to epsilon. Whoops.
Minus.
Dyslexia strikes again. So T over TC.
T is 1 plus epsilon. And
yeah, So anyway, so TC over T, then I can write as 1 plus epsilon. And again, there's higher order terms, but let's not worry about them. We're interested in the limit epsilon going to 0. And so TC over T minus 1 is just epsilon. So this thing, if I write it in that way, so this is going to be 3 epsilon. And now what is T over TC? So that's 1 minus epsilon cubed. And I'm interested in the limit when epsilon is going to 0. And so when epsilon is going to 0, this goes to 1. This is like the critical behavior. Yeah, so again, it's like it's important to appreciate like what you should keep, what you must keep, what you can safely throw away.
I have a question.
Yeah, far away.
The critical behavior exponents and the dimensionality.
Yes.
How does this, I guess this is a little bit separate, but in QFT, when we take D as 4 minus epsilon,
right,
is a problem with the non-trivial critical behavior at that dimension?
The point is that, okay, in quantum field theory and all that, we know that like 4 is the critical dimension and you're doing perturbation theory about 4 dimensions. And the whole goal of this is to compute critical exponents in like a perturbation theory about 4 dimensions. So at 4 dimensions, the critical exponents have the mean field values. Beta is 1/2, alpha is 0, gamma is 1, delta is 3. And in, you know, 4 minus epsilon dimensions, those critical exponents have slightly different values that you can write as a perturbation theory in D minus 4.
But shouldn't it cause, like since the behavior is so deeply different at 4 and below 4, like, doesn't it cause more problems to perturb it below 4 then?
Well, when you say deeply different, I'm not sure.
We can take the mean field approximation at D equals 4 or above, but below there's all this other behavior that comes into play.
Right.
Cause problems that
it does cause problems, and this is like what Wilson won a Nobel Prize, like how to do a calculational scheme that can calculate the critical exponents just below 4 dimensions. And so, you know, this perturbation theory and this fake parameter d minus 4 was a brilliant piece of calculational, of like insight and then incredible calculation. Yeah, so it does cause problems, and so that's why you win a Nobel Prize if you do that calculation. Yeah.
When you were talking about critical behaviors, you said your claim was kind of general. You said for any T that is less than the critical temperature,
yes,
you have that behavior. But now you just proved...
When you say that behavior, what?
And magnetization is... the behavior of magnetization is defined by the power law of temperature.
That's asymptotically close to the critical point.
Oh, so it's not... Oh, okay.
It's not going to hold like a T equals 1 million... I mean, like at 0.0001 T... I'm sorry, at 0.01 TC, so very far away from the critical point, there'll be other corrections that start being important. But very close to the critical point, the dominant behavior is just power law behavior. Yes?
You said that Mayfield behavior is at D larger than 4.
Right.
You were starting with the example of 2D.
Like... Yeah, yeah, but the thing is that I did an approximation, which turns out to be equivalent to stating that dimension is larger than 4. I replaced the true spin by the average spin. And like, one needs a lot more work to try and justify, first of all, why is this okay? And why it corresponds to dimension larger than 4. You had a question, yes?
I had a question. You have t greater than TC and then something equals 0, and I didn't catch what you said.
So say it again?
For the power law,
yeah.
Going as TC minus T.
Yeah.
Said that was valid as
T was below TC.
And then, So above TC,
the magnetization is zero, strictly zero. Again, because this equation has only one solution when T is above TC, because you know the two curves cross in such a way that there's only one possible solution.
This is at zero magnetic field?
Yeah, this is all again for zero magnetic field because I'm interested. Oh, thank you very much. This is and don't bring an apple next time though. Anyway, so yeah, so above T, you know, again, we're only dealing with zero magnetic field because we're only interested in spontaneous magnetization, because if there's a field, then there is magnetization anyway. So where do you get this bottle of water? Because I don't...
Like where you get free coffees. It's right there, right? There's a bunch of carafes like this.
Okay.
Or you can just ask the people and they'll pour you.
Okay. Since I don't drink coffee, I don't know about no coffee station. Okay, so let me continue on. So I want to now, what do I want to do now? I want to see which page of my notes I'm on. This page. Yes. Okay. All right, so this was our important formula here, the magnetization, is all the stuff here. Okay, so the next thing I want to discuss is the susceptibility. The front can go way up here because we don't need it anymore. The middle can go here. Okay, so susceptibility. And, you know, the English word susceptible means like how prone you are to doing something. So I'm susceptible to being, I don't know what I'm susceptible to. I'm susceptible to not drinking coffee. But anyway, susceptibility means like how ticklish is the system to some perturbation. And susceptibility is normally defined as dm by dh. And, you know, again, to do this properly in the framework of thermodynamics, we have to hold other parameters fixed. And so this is usually done at fixed temperatures. This is called chi, is the Greek letter for chi t. This is the isothermal susceptibility. Susceptibility. And so this is a measure of how ticklish is the system, how much, when you tickle the system with a little bit of additional magnetic field, how much response there is, how much more magnetization you get. And so this is the thing that I'd like to now try and understand in the context of the mean field Ising model. And so here again, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do everything as simple as possible. And so I'm going to say, let's look at the limit for t around tc. What happens there? So for t going to tc, that implies that m is small. So let's take our equation and expand it for when m is small. So there's our equation. And the thing is that because there's a non-zero magnetic field or the changing magnetic field, I've got to use our formula when h is non-zero. So I have m, which is equal to hyperbolic h of beta j plus beta j cm. And so if m is small, let me expand this for small m. And so this is going to be m approximately equal to beta j plus beta j cm.
What is the first term?
What is the first term? What?
Beta j term? Where does that come from?
I'm sorry, beta h. Sorry. Beta h. Beta h. Okay. So again, under the assumption that the magnetic field is small, the magnetization is small, I'm asking, like, when the system is poised near the critical point, I have almost no magnetization, I turn on a tiny magnetic field, how much does the system respond? And so I can get away with doing this kind of power series expansion. And now I can write this as, so I have m, 1 minus beta jz is equal to beta h. So m is equal to beta h, and here 1 minus beta jz. And so now let's write this in terms of things that we know, because we know that I can write this now as beta c times beta over beta c. So I've done nothing. And now, but this is equal to 1. And beta over beta c is tc over t. So this is the same as beta h 1 minus tc over t. So we see that at the critical point, when t is equal to tc, this blows up. And it blows up in a very specific power law way. And so from this thing, we can infer that the critical point exponent gamma is equal to 1. So that is second of the critical point exponents, gamma is equal to 1. Another important feature about the isothermal susceptibility is that when the system is very susceptible, that means that if I turn on a tiny magnetic field, the magnetization suddenly rises. And magnetization rising means that if the magnetic field is talking to me and it's telling me spin up, and then I influence you, but because the system is like poised at a critical point, then you influence your neighbor and so on. And so you get a very large spread of correlations in the system. So in fact, there is a one-to-one relationship between the magnetic susceptibility and spin correlations. And this is kind of the way, if you're an experimentalist, what people do by neutron scattering is they actually measure spin correlations directly by neutron scattering. So here I want to just talk about the relation to spin correlations.
I'm sorry, Sam.
Yes.
That's supposed to be chi, right? That's the formula for chi.
Yes. So, sorry. Yeah, so, okay. So this is, so, okay. I missed a step here. So we found this behavior. And now what I'm going to do is compute chi, which is the derivative of the magnetization with respect to magnetic field. So when I do that, so let me just put it over here. So that tells me that chi, thank you for keeping me honest here. So that's beta over 1 minus tc over t. Yeah, thank you. Relation to spin correlations. So what do I have to say about that? So here is the partition function of our Ising model. So z is equal to summation over all spin states. So I'll write sort of curly brackets to note you know, if I have n spins in the system, this is a summation over 2 to the n possible states. Each spin can be plus or minus. I have n spins. I have 2 to the n possible states. So it's a state, it's a summation over all possible spin states of the system. And then I have e to the minus beta Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian is over there, has a minus sign. So this is e to the plus beta j summation over all nearest neighbors ij si sj. So that's my partition function. And the magnetization, how would I compute that formally? So the magnetization is that I have to take the value of, and since everything is homogeneous, I can focus attention just on one spin and multiply by n to get the total magnetization of the system. But if I want the magnetization per spin, so typically I use little letter to denote magnetization per spin, I can take the average value of any spin in the system. So let me take the average value of the spin at the origin. And so what is this? This is going to be a summation over all spin states. S0, the value of the spin at the origin, which can either be plus or minus 1. So I'm going to have to sum up over all this. E to the beta j summation ij si sj. So now, and then I have to divide by the partition function. So now let's compute the susceptibility. So chi is equal to, and so this is susceptibility per spin, so dm by dh. Oh, sorry, I realized I missed something here. I forgot the magnetic field term, or else there's nothing's going to happen. So there's a minus sum hsi plus, plus beta hsi, so plus beta h summation si. All of that's up here. And then I have to divide by the partition function. Okay, fine. Sorry about that. So now we want to compute the susceptibility. And so if you look here, there are two places where the magnetic field appears. One is up here, and one is downstairs hidden inside of the partition function. So let's look at both of these terms in turn. So when I take dm by dh, because it's in the exponential, what's going to come downstairs is beta sum si. And again, so this is a sum over all spins in the system, si. This is a sum over all nearest neighbor pairs. So the first term is going to be a summation over all spin states. So there's going to be beta S0 summation over all sites SI. And then I have E to all of that stuff, which I won't write again, and then divided by the partition function. So that's the first term. And the second term, since I have to differentiate the h, it's inside the partition function, by differentiating, you get 1 over minus 1 over z squared, the derivative of the partition function with respect to h. So it'll be a 1 over z squared sitting here. And then there's going to be a sum over all spin states s0, e to the all of that stuff all over again. And then I'm differentiating the partition function with respect to h. And what is that going to do? That's going to bring for me another factor of e to all of that stuff again. And when I differentiate the h, there's going to be a summation over all I beta s I. So those are the two terms. And you know, again, like I've tried to avoid writing lots of same thing over and over again. And so if you look at this, here we have s0 si summed over all states and all spins in the system, the thermal average of that. So the first term is nothing more than, so let me write this as pi, is equal to nothing more than S0 Si summation over all sites I. The second term, so we have, so one Z I can put with this term, another Z I can put with this term. This guy is just a thermal average of S0. This guy is a thermal average of summation beta si. And so this second term is nothing more than S0 si. And put here brackets so that everything is inside the sum. So this is the relation between the magnetic susceptibility and spin correlations. So this thing is often called a two-spin correlation function. And so it's a measure of like how much spins are correlated as a, and here the distance, you know, like the sum is over all spins in the system. So we're summing over spins that are close. So like we're close to each other. So, you know, how much we're correlated, and you guys in the back, you're further away. We can measure how much we're correlated. And so the sum of all these spin correlation functions is related very simply to the susceptibility. Now there is a subtraction here. And so in fact, the whole thing is sometimes called the connected two spin correlation function. And you know, people who do quantum field theory will worry about connected, you know, there's Wick's theorem, and there's all this other fancy schmancy stuff that I barely remember anymore. But anyways, the point is that above the critical temperature, the mean value of the spin is zero. There's no magnetization, so this doesn't matter. So it's only below the critical point that you have to worry about this term, and it's just a natural way of actually defining the spin correlation function. And so it's a measure of, let's just talk about above TC just for simplicity. So as you get closer and closer to the critical point, the susceptibility is getting larger. And what that means is that there's correlations, the spins are getting more and more correlated. And as the correlations diverge, you'll also have a divergence of the magnetic susceptibility. So there's a very simple relation between the amount of spin correlations and the magnetic susceptibility. That's, we'll see it raise its head when I solve the one-dimensional Ising model, I guess, next time. Yes.
So what did you do with the beta?
Oh, what did I do with the beta? I just forgot about it. Yeah, so, okay. So that's how I'll get.
So that's one thing. And another thing is.
Yeah, it's usually because you write KT times chi, yes.
The exponent of your magnetization, for example, is that the exact same thing that we had for Z, for the partition function, or should it be the sigma of S0, Sj?
I'm not sure I understand your question yet.
The exponent of magnetization here, for this, in this sigma, the second law.
Here, yes.
The exponent has to be
the entire.
Exactly this way, do I and J include I equals zero, or?
This sum over all i's, like every single spin in the system, this is a sum over all pairs. So when I did the differentiation, this will have a term, this I will go over all sides of the lattice. It'll be one term that involves S0 times S0 will be that term, but there's all other spins in the system as well.
I'm trying to understand why the first one is the two spin correlation and the second one is decoupled.
No, but the reason why it's decoupled is that you see, this guy only involved S0. So let me put this over Z here. And let me put this guy over Z here. This guy has nothing to do with, this is the true thermal average of the spin at site zero. It's, you know, S0 times the Boltzmann factor divided by the partition function. This guy is, for each site I, we are calculating the thermal average for each site I, the value of the spin multiplied by the Boltzmann factor divided by the partition function. That's just the definition of the average value.
But why would you take the derivative with respect to H for the first term? Why should that sigma be correlated with everything else and not be separated as well?
I'm not sure I'm getting your question. I mean, I'm differentiating with respect to H. And so I always bring down this factor sum over I, Si, that's every single spin in the system. And so when I'm differentiating in the numerator, this thing is exactly put to here.
Because the only difference between your first term and the second term is extra exponential. Everything is exactly the same.
That's right.
So can't I just say that my first term is exactly my second term, but times an exponential minus?
No, I mean, again, I think what I would say here is spend 10 minutes staring at this formula, write everything out, like where I put dot, 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 write it out carefully and convince yourself either that what I've done is correct or come with me with like a really focused question, because this part is independent of this part, because this whole thing here is the Boltzmann factor, and I'm computing the average value of S, you know, this is the definition of the average value. It's,
the exponent, I think this is a concentrated question now. Isn't the exponent just a constant It doesn't depend on the sigma outside, right? It doesn't depend on the sigma.
No, outside. No, there is a, because you know there's inside of here. This is sum over all. You know, there's a term here, beta summation si, beta h, but inside of si, one of the sites is site zero. I mean, this is sum over I equals, you know, one to n, the total number of spins in the system. One of those terms is S zero. So that's why I'm saying write it out carefully and convince yourself. And so, yes, you had a question.
Yeah, I had a question back about the susceptibility and how it plays into our beta coefficient, because it seems like for this to be positive, we might need like T greater than TC, but in that case, we got the magnetization was zero.
Right.
Not, then we find beta is negative one here, right, as opposed to the 1/2 that we found before. So how does that play in, or like, does that have anything to do with our critical behavior of the beta?
Well, so I guess what I would say here is there, you know, you've raised a good question, and yes, there's a little bit of sloppiness involved here, but I guess what I'd say is this, all this development is appropriate for T just a little bit below TC. For T above TC, the magnetization is zero. And so, like, I can't, you know, so I would just have zero here. I'd have nothing. So one has to do something else different to show that the susceptibility is actually, this formula is true for both above TC and below TC. I've only done for below TC.
But so isn't beta negative one in this case for M, where we have T minus TC?
Beta is negative one.
No, this beta coefficient. Sorry.
Yeah, that beta is different from that beta.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. But I'm saying that here we have T minus TC to the negative one, so our critical exponent beta should be negative one.
No, the critical exponent for the susceptibility. No, but this is, excuse me. First of all, this is the magnetization at non-zero magnetic field. This is not the spontaneous magnetization. Pardon me?
Sorry, this is little m, not big M. Is that the difference?
No. This is the magnetization at non-zero magnetic field. So it's not the spontaneous magnetization. It is the induced magnetization.
Can't use the first formula you've written on the board there.
No, because that first formula is for at zero magnetic field. And this is for non-zero magnetic field. So these are two very different formulas. And yes, I now also see there is this problem that normally in beta, which is 1 over kt, is also a critical point exponent. So I hope they'll be clear by context when I mean beta is a critical point exponent and beta is 1 over kt. Yes?
So on the list there, you say for d more than or equal to 4.
Yes.
You can use the mean field.
Yes.
I mean, behavior.
Right.
But the computation that we just did, I think.
This is completely general. This is a completely general formula. This has nothing to do with dimension four or whatever. This is general.
I don't understand the difference between that. In that case, I don't understand that distinction between the dimensions. Like, if this is a general formula, then the general behavior of the Ising model and any dimension is of this.
No, it's all it's just saying is that the relation between spin correlation functions and the susceptibility is given by this in any dimension. This is a relation between spin correlations and susceptibility. And part of the reason I was like focusing on this point, or like emphasizing this point, is the fact that spin correlations are what can be directly measured in neutron scattering experiments. And that's how people actually measure the susceptibility. You don't like to have a magnetic system and turn the magnetic field up. You have a dial that you turn up and down. You actually do neutron scattering, measure the spin correlations, and from that infer the magnetic susceptibility.
Given this equation and the thing that we had beforehand, is it telling us that the spin correlation is completely captured by the temperature of the system? Like, no matter what we do to our system, how we fine tune spins.
Right.
That we can always have the same spin correlation for all, it's just a function of temperature, not initial condition.
Right. I mean, well, again, we're talking about equilibrium statistical physics, so initial condition doesn't mean anything here, because we're saying in equilibrium, we wait for the age of the universe until the system equilibrates, and we're asking what is the behavior, and there is a simple relation between the magnetic susceptibility in equilibrium and the spin correlations in equilibrium. So there's no initial conditions, because I'm saying, imagining time is going to infinity and I have just the equilibrium.
If you just like put all of our spins, fine tune all of the spins like up, like at zero, then the interaction is going to be like, I expect this system to be at equilibrium at all temperature, like a system that all of the spins are up.
No, because the thing is that if you put all the spins up, for example, and you're below the critical temperature, yes, then it's very hard. First of all, this is going to happen like maybe a week and a half from now. We're going to talk about non-equilibrium phenomena in the Ising model. But just to sort of jump a bit ahead, first of all, if there's thermal agitation, you know, so you're imagining you have your spins up and you're shaking your box, there's some thermal agitation. At some point, like a spin is going to flip because of thermal agitation, because it's going to absorb a phonon, it's going to go to another, you know, it'll be a go to excited state. So you get a little droplet of misaligned spins. And if you wait a long enough time, a droplet of misaligned spins get large enough that it nucleates a switch to the other spin state. So it'll happen on a very long time scale, but it will happen. And this is called the nucleation theory of phase transition. That, you know, I may say something more about a week or so from now. But right now, let's just deal with equilibrium. And when we get to non-equilibrium, we'll be out of equilibrium. I guess this is a reasonable stopping point. So just so you know where I'm going to go next time is, so I've now calculated the critical point exponent beta, the critical point exponent gamma. So we've got to do alpha and delta. So that will happen next time. I'll talk about those. I'll also give the solution to the one-dimensional Ising model. I'll pay some lip service to what happens in greater than one dimension. And then we'll turn to the normalization group. So questions. Why don't you go first?
A follow-up for David's question. Did we invoke the mean field theory in this spin correlation?
No. No, again, this is completely general. This is general, yeah. There's a simple relation between so in fact, this is an example of what's called the fluctuation dissipation relation, because here, this is sort of a measure of fluctuations, you know, like how much when I tickle the system that it responds. And this part is the dissipation part. And so this is an example of fluctuation dissipation theory. Yes.
You said this is general, it doesn't have anything to do with mean field behavior, and I understand
right.
that. But you said this is derived from T less than TC, but I don't see anywhere you're using that fact here. It just
No, so sorry. I mean, again, what happened up to here?
Gamma equal to one, the right hand side.
No, so yeah, this part is for below TC. This is true in general.
Yeah.
And the only thing is that above TC, these two terms will be zero because there's no spontaneous magnetization. So fluctuation dissipation theorem is general, all temperatures, all, you know, whatever. Yeah, ask away, go ahead.
For that M, you calculate there, what does it mean for M to blow up at TC?
What does it mean to blow up?
Because I can't understand why.
Again, it's really important to like appreciate like when what's being done asymptotically. First of all, I'm doing this expansion for small m. So I'm making the assumption that the magnetic field is small, magnetization is small, I'm close to TC, everything is small. And so I derive this formula, and it's only going to be valid in the limit where both m is small and h is small. So, you know, you're right, this blows up. You know, if you're not careful, but I already built in M is small, so I should only apply this formula in a regime where the magnetization is small. I can't apply it where the magnetization is large, because the power series that I did here, I only kept the first term. That's not going to be valid anymore.
But here you're assuming that your magnetic field is small and your T is very much close to TC from below.
Right. So one has to be careful about how you're taking these limits.
So the limit being H is even smaller than the amount.
Yes. Yes.
Close to TC.
Exactly. And so, you know, if you again, you don't know this yet because I haven't done it. But when I derive, like for the critical isotherm, we're going to do the same kind of thing. Like you're going to say, well, we're going to assume things are small, and you'll see, like in this case, it's a little bit more clear what you're throwing away, because you have to be careful about how you do the approximation. So you're absolutely correct. You have to be very careful here. I'm assuming M is small, H is small. So I can't apply the formula for all values of T, because it just blows up and then it doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit more as to why we should conceive of a correlation function as a dissipation? Like what's the relation between those ideas?
Maybe I said this exactly backwards. Maybe it's like the MDH is the dissipation and this is the fluctuation. You know, I'd like, again, I'm not sure let me put that in abeyance, but I mean, just think of it just as it's like some words. It's called the fluctuation dissipation relation, but there's a relation between susceptibility and spin correlations. Yeah. So I guess that's it for today.